You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. The first-time penalty for possessing up to 14 grams of marijuana in Wisconsin could be brought down to a $100 fine and no jail time. That's one of the objectives of a new bipartisan bill a pair of state lawmakers introduced this week. On the other hand, the measure would actually increase penalties in some communities. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Where do you stand on legalizing marijuana? Do you support medicinal but not recreational? Both? Neither? Why or why not? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Laurel White is WPR's Capitol Bureau reporter. She covered a press conference earlier this week held by the bill's co-sponsors, Republican Representative Shea Sortwell from Two Rivers and Democratic Representative Sylvia Ortiz-Velez of Milwaukee. Laurel, welcome back to Central Time.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
There have been efforts to change marijuana laws over the years in Wisconsin. They haven't gone very far. Can you remind us before we look at this new proposal, what we've seen in the past?
So we've seen a lot of action on marijuana bills over the past several years and certainly before as well. But I think it's become sort of a different kind of conversation since Governor Tony Evers took office. He has included marijuana proposals in both of his state budgets. The first state budget that he released in 2019 had legalization of medical marijuana in Wisconsin. His most recent state budget included legalization of recreational marijuana in the state. So this is something that he has certainly, backed, but it hasn't been possible because of the Republican majorities in the state legislature. They haven't taken those up. We've seen, in the past, lawmakers under a Republican governor trying to push these bills from the Democratic side. For the most part, there have been some bipartisan medical marijuana bills as well, but just not enough support from the Republican side to get those through.
So here's this new proposal, a Republican and a Democrat getting together on this. It is not legalization exactly, not even decriminalization exactly. What would it do?
Basically, what it would do is create a statewide standard for what marijuana possession penalties are going to look like in Wisconsin for the most part. So right now, the state penalty is for possession, first-time possession. It's a misdemeanor, which comes with a jail sentence of up to 6 months, a penalty up to $1,000. There's obviously some discretion there in sentencing. The interesting part about state law where this is concerned, though, is that local communities are allowed, if they want to, establish their own penalties for possession up to a certain amount, up to about 28 grams of marijuana. And so some communities in Wisconsin, including Madison and Milwaukee, obviously the two biggest communities, have done that, and they have pretty low penalties. Madison actually doesn't pursue any penalties for possession if folks are over 18 years old and they have less than 28 grams. In Milwaukee County, the fine is just a dollar. This is also the case in the city of Eau Claire, for example. There's a $1 fine. So it really varies across the state. And under this proposal, there would be a new state standard where it would be a $100 civil forfeiture, similar to a speeding ticket, or a cap of a $250 civil forfeiture. So it kind of sets these parameters for communities that they say, you can still do this. You can still kind of set your own guidelines, your own penalties, but it has to be within this window. It does offer the potential for community service, at least 16 hours, not more than 40 hours, if they don't want to have that penalty. But obviously, when you're looking at a place like Madison that doesn't do anything, this would increase what's happening there, right? So definitely a little bit complicated, but an interesting dynamic.
Talking to Laurel White, WPR State Capitol reporter, about a bipartisan proposal for a change in fines and the laws regarding marijuana in Wisconsin. I want to give a listen to the Democratic co-sponsor, Representative Ortiz-Velez, talking earlier this week about another aspect of the bill.
What we should think about is whether or not we believe that small possession of marijuana really rises to a felonious act. It does not.
So, Laurel, felonies for marijuana. Now, first offenses, I don't think, are where do felonies enter the picture here?
So felonies enter the picture here when you have repeat offenses, possession offenses with marijuana. And what this proposal would do outside of that sort of standardization of the penalties that I talked about is it would take away those felony charges for repeat possession as long as the amount in the charge, in the repeat possession charge, is less than 28 grams. And supporters say this is really important because felony charges, as we know, are a serious thing for folks to have on their record. They put up barriers for things that you can do and can't do in the state. They make it harder for folks to get jobs, for folks to get housing. And so supporters say this change would be really beneficial to a lot of Wisconsinites.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Kevin is with us in Pembine. Kevin, hi.
Hello, yes. I just heard about this first thing this morning on the news. But what I hear is all great and everything. I think it's good, but really, it's very time for the state to consider legalization. Because I told the gal on the phone, I don't know if you guys have any idea how much tax revenue is flowing out of the state of Wisconsin into Illinois and Michigan, and I'm a proud contributor to the tax base of Michigan myself personally. And it's time. You know, I mean, they're losing a lot of money.
Kevin, thanks for that call. And you referenced Laurel, Governor Evers proposing legalization in his budget, and the budget counted on some of that revenue that Kevin's talking about.
It sure did, yeah. When he proposed recreational marijuana legalization in this last budget, he figured in quite a lot of revenue that would come from that. And that's another argument that proponents have made for quite a while. Is that the revenue that it would bring in, and have noted that Wisconsin is kind of surrounded by states that have more lenient, you know, laws related to marijuana and legalization. You know, Illinois has recreational marijuana. Michigan, as mentioned, has recreational marijuana. Minnesota has medical. So it's, yeah, that's definitely a big part of the conversation, but that argument just hasn't been compelling enough for the Republican-controlled legislature so far.
Thanks for that call. I want to give a listen now to the Republican co-author here, Republican Shea Sortwell, talk about this as a bipartisan effort.
I believe this bill that we have put together does our best to kind of pull together the best of both worlds, try to bring together all perspectives across the state to try to find some sort of middle ground where we can move forward.
Still early days for this legislation, Laurel. Does it seem like members of either or both parties are jumping forward and onto what we just heard described as middle ground there?
Well, we know so far there are about a dozen sponsors from, you know, combination of the two parties. It does have bipartisan support, obviously, already. It's going to be really interesting to see how far this moves in the process. Representative Sortwell said that he, quote, didn't get a no from Republican leadership about whether this was going to get a committee hearing and move forward through that sort of, you know, step-by-step legislative process. But his argument there, as we heard, is that, you know, they believe, sponsors believe that this is a middle ground. It doesn't please everybody. It certainly doesn't legalize marijuana, but it doesn't, ramp up penalties in a huge way either. So it's not really on either side of the issue. They say this is a middle ground. Nobody wins, but hopefully it's a step forward for folks. So that's kind of where it's at right now.
We'll leave it there. Laurel, thanks again for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, Rob.
Laurel White is WPR's state capitol reporter. We talked with her about a new bipartisan bill aimed at lowering penalties for possessing marijuana in most of Wisconsin. There are, as we heard, some communities that would actually see an increase in fines. Coming up, we'll talk with a congressional reporter about a pair of marijuana bills at the federal level and their prospects for getting passed. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about how marijuana, medicinal and recreational, is treated by the federal government? Do you want to see the states keep taking the lead? Do you want Wisconsin to do something? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We just heard about a bipartisan effort in Wisconsin to address marijuana policy. Now we'll look at efforts in the nation's capital to move the needle, though Democrats there may be getting in their own way, our next guest reports. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on marijuana legalization or decriminalization at the state or federal level. The number is 800-642-1234. Mike DeBonis covers Congress for The Washington Post. Mike, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me. Really appreciate it.
You've been following two bills, Mike, one fairly narrow, one bigger when it comes to marijuana before Congress. Can you compare and contrast? What are these two pieces of legislation looking like?
Sure. Like most things on Capitol Hill, you know, the bigger you go, sometimes the narrower the support gets. So on marijuana, there's a narrower bill that just has to do with the banking system. Basically, what it does is give legitimate businesses in states that have legalized cannabis in some way access to the banking system. It makes it basically tells banks that if you want to do business with legitimate businesses, where the federal government is not going to charge you, it's not going to investigate you, it's not going to levy administrative fines against you, you go ahead and do business with them. And that's a big issue for businesses who in states that are operating legally. Right now, a lot of them have to deal solely in cash. You know, it really is a cash-only business that leads to all sorts of security concerns, logistical concerns. It's become a big problem, and it's really been something that states want to see handled because they see it as a security issue, a law enforcement issue. And, you know, they basically want to rationalize this system. And there's been legislation now for 8 years in Congress to basically do this. It hasn't gone anywhere for a variety of reasons. Now you have Democrats in charge of, you know, the White House, the House, the Senate. You know, they are generally not, you know, 99% of the members are in favor of legal, you know, some sort of marijuana decriminalization. There's great, almost universal support for the banking bill. But what you have is you have an effort by many of these members to do something much broader, something that includes actually decriminalizing marijuana, taking it off the schedule of controlled substances, making it something that's taxed federally, something that's regulated federally. And these latest Democratic proposals have, you know, racial justice provisions in them. They basically say that this tax money that's raised should go to the communities that were most affected by the drug war. That money should be funneled back into those communities. There should be programs to help minority entrepreneurs get into business. Obviously, though, those provisions are controversial. They are not. They don't have much support, if any, among Republicans, and that makes it hard to move forward with this legislation, particularly in the Senate, where you need, you know, 10 Republican votes under the filibuster to make progress. And so that's where things are right now. And Senator Chuck Schumer, the majority leader, has made the decision that he is not going to move a piecemeal bill like the Safe Banking Act. What he's going to do is try to get support for this broader bill, even though it's really unclear how that is going to happen, how there's a path to passage for that broader bill. So right now, things are stuck.
And you report that some supporters of a broader bill worry that if they do the smaller thing, the banking and marijuana-related bill, that that'll be all the progress and people will give up on wider efforts. Do I have that right?
Yeah, basically, it takes away the momentum for doing something more. You know, this is something that we've seen happen on any number of issues. You know, immigration comes to mind. There are people who do small things or are ready to do small things on immigration, but there are a lot of members that don't want to do the small deal because they're afraid that takes away momentum for the big deal that brings in a lot of other different issues that they want to see resolved. And it's kind of a classic story, but it can be a frustrating one, particularly for businesses in states, you know, like, you know, Colorado, Oregon, you know, go down the list of states that have legal recreational marijuana at this point. You know, this is by some estimates an $18 billion a year business revenue-wise across the country for legal marijuana. And, you know, they basically have no access to the banking system. They have to deal in cash. They have to do all sorts of workarounds. And it causes just a lot of problems that could be pretty easily resolved through an actually very short piece of legislation.
We're talking about marijuana policy and Congress. Mike DeBonis is with us from the Washington Post, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want federal law to change to decriminalize marijuana? What about this smaller banking bill that makes it legal, easier for banks to get involved in the marijuana business and make loans to it in states unlike Wisconsin where it is legal? Let's bring on a caller now. Colette is with us in Sauk County. Colette, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Colette?
Well, I believe it should be legalized. A lot of Wisconsinites are driving to Illinois just to use to go and purchase their marijuana and then driving back to Wisconsin. So basically, we're giving our taxes away to Illinois. We could be getting them here. And also, a lot of people, they use it for pain. When they use it, they're relaxed, they're calm, rather than going to the bar, getting all hyped up and, you know, drunk. I just think that it should be legalized. I don't know why it hasn't yet.
Colette, thanks a lot for the call. Mike Colette bringing up the revenue argument, and it's also a patchwork issue. Are people in Congress talking about the weird situation that's created when it's legal in some states, so like Illinois and not in Michigan, but not in other states like Wisconsin?
Yeah, for sure. And that's sort of underlying this whole issue is that, you know, particularly for conservatives, you know, this argument that states should, you know, be able to do what, you know, sort of choose their own destiny on their laws and not have to worry about federal intervention is kind of driving some of the Republican support for this. And, you know, that's where the sort of the common ground lies. And where you lose common ground is where you start talking about things like taxing and regulating, and then you get into how much should the taxes be. You know, the heavy hand of federal regulation obviously is rarely popular among conservative lawmakers. That's when things get more complicated. But when you frame it in terms of we're going to protect states who are trying to do what and follow their own destiny, do what they want, protect them from federal intervention, that's pretty powerful argument that can attract Republicans.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Mike DeBonis from the Washington Post. Let's go back to your calls now. Sean is with us from South Beloit, Illinois. Sean, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about from south of our border there?
Yeah, so I actually was originally from Wisconsin. When I was younger, I was on the First Offenders Program when I was unfortunately caught for marijuana. And I successfully completed the program for that First Offenders Program. And now I actually live in South Beloit, Illinois, due to the fact that I can legally obtain marijuana for myself due to medical issues for myself. And I do think it would be great for Wisconsin to, you know, get on that realm where they're able to, just for younger people, older people, just to be able to not have to deal with either the fact of, you know, misdemeanor charges, felony charges for multiple offenses, but just for younger people, maybe not to deal with the First Offenders Program where they have to deal with like a year, worrying about other illegal charges that may happen, because I just know that was an extra stressor for me as a younger person just turning 18.
Sean, thanks a lot for sharing your story. Mike, Sean voting with his feet there. And public opinion, at least according to polling, has changed a lot on this issue. I think that's been pushing some states to legalize. Is Congress watching that changing opinion?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's been a huge shift, and it's happened fairly fast. Pew did a poll earlier this year. A plurality of U.S. Adults now believe that recreational marijuana should be legalized. Almost as many, another chunk of the population believes it should be legalized for medicinal use. Together, that's 90% of the population that agrees that it should be legal in some manner. It's just a huge shift, and it's to a lot of people in Congress, it's unconscionable that there really has been no significant change to federal drug laws since really the height of the drug war in the 80s and 90s. They just have not changed at all, and there's been no effort to accommodate states that have decided at the state level to decriminalize or legalize cannabis.
Sean, thanks for the call. Time for one more caller. David is with us in Madison. David, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about?
Well, I'm a chronic pain patient,
and I listened pretty intently to the fellow who was on a week ago talking about the opioid epidemic, all the problems with that. He doesn't even think that there are people who live with chronic pain. The guy hasn't got it. So maybe if marijuana would help me get off of my opioids that I've been prescribed to for over a decade, and I'm in my 70s, and I go to a couple, three different pain groups, and nobody there can use marijuana for medical use or whatever, because we all end up at a moment's notice have to give a urine sample.
David, I'm sorry to hear about that chronic pain story. Is this something, Mike, people are bringing up, marijuana as an option for people like David, as opposed to our ongoing opioid crisis?
It is 100% that you hear this a lot. That you hear it a lot, especially from Republicans who represent areas that have been really affected by the opioid crisis. We saw just this week a Republican congressman from North Carolina, Nancy Mace, introduce a decriminalization bill. It would take marijuana off the list of controlled substances. It would do some tax and regulation, smaller than what the Democrats want. But you know, she has pitched this in part, like I said, on the states' rights issue, that states should be able to do what they want. But there's a lot of sentiment among Republicans that the medicinal, aspects of this are compelling, particularly when you see it as an alternative to opioids.
And we'll have to leave it there. Thanks to Mike DeBonis from The Washington Post looking at marijuana policy. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, Kyle Rittenhouse was found not guilty on all charges related to killing two people in Kenosha. A legal expert explains the decision. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Food Friday, you might be looking forward to lots of good food on Thanksgiving, but preparing and cooking it, maybe not so much. We'll get some advice on how to simplify our Thanksgiving meals so we can spend less time in the kitchen and more time with our guests. First, a jury has found Kyle Rittenhouse not guilty on all charges. That's after shooting three people last summer in Kenosha, killing two of them and injuring a third. The shootings took place during the unrest after the shooting of Jacob Blake. During the trial, the prosecution argued Rittenhouse provoked the violence by bringing a rifle to the protests. Defense attorneys said the shootings were in self-defense. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What's your reaction to the Rittenhouse verdict? Do you feel like the jury got it right or wrong? What did you think of how the trial went? What piece of evidence or testimony stood out most to you? And what do you think of self-defense laws? We'll be talking about that some today. Do you think they need to be changed? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. John Gross is a clinical associate professor of law at the University of Wisconsin Law School and director of the Public Defender Project. John, welcome back to Central Time.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, as we talked about last time you were on, a lot of this case centered around the concept of self-defense on all of these counts. Was that key to the verdict today?
I'm sure it was. I mean, although the jury doesn't tell us specifically why they found the defendant not guilty, it was very clear from the presentation of the evidence that Mr. Rittenhouse was asserting that he was privileged to use deadly force in self-defense. That's what the defense team argued. That's what the prosecution argued against, that he was not justified in doing that. And so with the acquittal on all of the counts, I think the message is that the jury was not convinced that he was not acting in self-defense.
You wrote in a piece that came out earlier today that you expected this acquittal, these not guilty verdicts, because of your reading of self-defense law. Looking at that narrowly, not looking at the wider context and political debates around the country regarding First and Second Amendment rights, you think that under the letter of the law was the right call?
I do. I know that the verdict will be frustrating for some folks. I know that they will look at this scenario and say, why is he privileged to use self-defense? He was a 17-year-old with a dangerous weapon. He was out when there was a curfew saying that he shouldn't be out. You know, he was engaging with these other protesters and demonstrators. And so doesn't this amount to some type of provocation that does not allow him to resort to deadly force? But that simply is not the way the law is written. So I don't think if people are tempted to say they feel like the jury got it wrong, I don't think that's fair to say. I think the jury was following the law as it was given to them. And this is the result that the law dictates.
You went on to write, though, that the law should maybe change. What do you think we need to reexamine in our self-defense laws here in Wisconsin?
Well, I think there is this issue about openly carrying firearms, particularly firearms that are high capacity, are extremely dangerous in terms of being semi-automatic. You know, many people feel uncomfortable around those types of weapons. In certain situations where it doesn't seem to be warranted, necessary, even useful to have those weapons openly carried. And I think the question becomes, do we want to think about perhaps regulating some of the situations in which we think it's appropriate to have those types of weapons? There are other issues about, you know, at what point does someone gain the privilege to use self-defense? Is it enough that somebody is attempting to reach for the gun that you have when they're concerned about their own safety because you're carrying a gun? Does that provide justification for using deadly force? And so there are a lot of questions to ask about things like the standard of proof that we require. In this case, prosecutors needed to disprove beyond a reasonable doubt that Mr. Rittenhouse was acting in self-defense. And so they weren't able to do that. And I think, again, under the facts and circumstances of this case, I think the jury came to the right result. But if people feel strongly that this was not the right result, then the thing to look at is how we apply and how we define self-defense under the law.
How does Wisconsin's self-defense law compare to other states?
It's not inconsistent with what other states do. I don't want to suggest that Wisconsin is an outlier here. I don't think we are. But I think the question does come up, you know, when we talk about the use of deadly force and when we talk about the use of certain types of firearms, should we be thinking about making it harder for someone to claim that they were entitled to use a firearm to shoot someone? I'm not suggesting that, you know, I have a definitive answer about this, but I do think it's something that should be open for debate and discussion, especially if people think that the acquittal of Mr. Rittenhouse does not comport with their sense of justice. Then again, the discussion should be about how do we define self-defense? When is someone entitled to use it? And especially when it's self-defense with a deadly weapon like a firearm.
John Gross is with us, clinical associate professor of law at the University of Wisconsin Law School, director of the Public Defender Project, looking at the not guilty verdicts and all charges against Kyle Rittenhouse, the verdicts released earlier this afternoon. You can join in with your reactions or your questions for our guest at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll go to a caller now. Mitch is with us in East Troy. Mitch, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to just address the fact that it's interesting that in this case, the guy that pulled the Glock on Kyle Rittenhouse and was actually moving towards him and about to execute him in the head with his 9mm Glock was not even brought charges on. So I think it's interesting when we're talking about, you know, possibly relooking at the law itself about when you're allowed to defend yourself, that the prosecutor in this case didn't even bring charges on the guy that was under video evidence to have brought a Glock almost directly to the side of Kyle Rittenhouse's head.
Mitch, thanks for the call. I'm not sure John was that person charged. I honestly don't know.
No, that was Mr. Grosskreutz, and there was a question put to him during the trial about the fact that he was carrying a concealed weapon. He had previously had a permit to carry a concealed weapon. It had lapsed at the time of the shooting in Kenosha, and he talked about that a little bit on the stand, admitted that, but also said that he had, for all of his adult life, regularly carried a pistol with him in for purposes of self-defense.
Thanks for the call, Mitch. And a tricky thing about self-defense is it's easy to imagine situations in which both parties believe they are defending themselves. In this case, protesters may have believed that Kyle Rittenhouse, with his weapon, who had already shot someone at that point, maybe not knowing the circumstances, believed he was an active threat and could claim that they were acting in self-defense, as did Kyle Rittenhouse. Is there something to that?
Oh, there's absolutely something to that. And this is the type of volatile environment where Wisconsin's open carry law, it may cause far more harm than any good, because in this type of chaotic environment that you saw that evening in Kenosha, there were people who were openly carrying firearms. There were people who had concealed firearms. There was a lot of confusion and chaos, demonstrations, counter demonstrations, people who said they were just there to try to keep order and protect property. And in that type of environment, it's very difficult to tell who is a threat to your safety when so many people are walking around with weapons. And so, you know, everybody has a Second Amendment right, everybody has First Amendment rights, but I think one of the questions we have to sort of sort through is when people are demonstrating or exercising First Amendment rights, does it make sense in those environments to sanction the open carrying of firearms that could be perceived as threatening or could frankly diminish people's willingness to exercise their First Amendment rights if they're going to be confronted with a line of folks who are armed with these type of military style weapons?
We're talking to John Gross, clinical associate professor of law at the University of Wisconsin Law School and director of the Public Defender Project. He's with us today to talk about the verdict in the Kyle Rittenhouse trial announced earlier today, the jury finding Rittenhouse not guilty on all charges. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What's your reaction to Rittenhouse being acquitted on all charges? Do you feel like justice has been served, or are you disappointed in the outcome? Do you think we need to revisit self-defense laws in Wisconsin or around the country? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our conversation about today's verdict, finding Kyle Rittenhouse not guilty on all charges. John Gross is with us, clinical associate professor of law at the UW Law School, director of the Public Defender Project. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your reaction, with your questions for our guest. The number is 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls. Mark is with us in Milwaukee. Mark, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I am very disappointed but not surprised. I think the way the judge treated the prosecution in front of the jury biased the jury against the prosecution. I'm wondering if our guests could answer this question. Would the families of the victims be able to bring, or could there be civil rights actions brought against Rittenhouse in federal court?
Mark, thanks for the call. Let's tackle each of those in turn. First of all, John, observers, especially those hoping, I think, for a different outcome, thought they saw bias from the judge in this case against the prosecution. What are your thoughts on that?
I did not really perceive Judge Schroeder as being biased in this case. I think people had very strong opinions about this case going into it. We all knew what the facts of the case were. There were no surprises during the trial. And so if you started from the position where you believed Mr. Rittenhouse should be found guilty, then what rulings the judge made were filtered through that lens, right? And if you felt strongly in the other way, you again had a particular, I think, bias starting out. I think the judge was holding the prosecution to their burden of proof in this case. And it was something that In the end, they just couldn't meet.
And then Mark had also asked about possible civil suits from the families here. As I understand it, the state, after an acquittal, can't appeal that. The federal charges could be brought, but I don't think there's any movement toward doing that. Is there an opportunity? Are there grounds for someone to file civil suits, though?
Oh, there, yeah. I think the caller he mentioned civil rights, and that's not really something that would happen here because civil rights violations are committed by state actors. So if police officers were to commit a homicide and it was unjustified, then the federal agencies could investigate and there could be a prosecution in federal court. But there could also be civil filings in this case for wrongful death. Those filings might not be just against Mr. Rittenhouse. They might also include the city of Kenosha. And because of the conditions that existed that night, because of police officers at least tacitly approving the presence of Mr. Rittenhouse and other folks who were armed, and also there in violation of the curfew that had been set out. So there may be more litigation down the road, yes.
Thanks for the call, Mark, at 800-642-1234. We'll go to Erica now in Lake Tomahawk. Erica, hi.
Hello. I just wanted to my thoughts on it. Now, I am a vet. I spent 6 years in the Army. I've been fired upon, and I've fired back. Carrying a weapon is an inherently aggressive act, and this punk didn't go down there to guard anything. He went down to shoot someone. They didn't seem to bring this out in the trial. He was marching around with that gun to his shoulder. Basically, I felt looking for someone to shoot. Well, by God, he did. And then he cried and felt bad for himself. Somebody's going to beat him up, conk him over the head with a skateboard, and he shot him dead. Well, that's like, that's a pretty wicked response. And that didn't seem to come out in that. He went down there to kill someone.
Thanks for the call. John, that motivation, obviously the jury didn't see it that way, but also with open carry laws, there's nothing that says you, I guess, can't carry a weapon in that fashion, right?
That's correct. And the caller's point about viewing that behavior as inherently aggressive is really what gets to the heart of this issue. Some people firmly believe that Mr. Rittenhouse's behavior by arming himself in that way, by carrying that type of weapon in the way he was carrying it with it strapped to his body, that this suggests that he had some ill intent, that he was going there looking, as the caller said, to engage in violence, to shoot someone. And that in fact, going armed in that manner is provocative, it is a provocation for folks. And so if people responded by attempting to take the weapon away from him, or they responded aggressively toward him because of that, then he is essentially creating the dangerous situation where he feels he needs to use deadly force. And the law, to be clear, doesn't allow you to provoke the other person and then use deadly force. But with an open carry law, it's difficult to argue that he's doing something that is provocative. In fact, the legislature, when they passed the open carry law, they went back and rewrote the disorderly conduct statute to say that somebody openly carrying a gun absent some other evidence is not creating a disturbance. And that's where people differ.
Thanks for that call. We were talking about the verdict in the Kyle Rittenhouse charges, not guilty on those charges. John Gross is with us from UW Law School. Back to your calls now. We've got Jeff on the line in Schofield. Jeff, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
Thanks for taking my call. This boy at the time was a victim of Old West justice. He was tried and in the media the entire time. He was found guilty before the trial even started in the media and public opinion. The verdict was justified, and all these people with these opinions on what happened at that site, if you didn't watch the entire trial from beginning to end, you have no say in this, absolutely none, because they're speculating and they're guessing just like the media did from day one. Justice was finally done, and everybody that raged race against this thing, they're absolutely insane. I don't see where anybody that didn't watch the whole trial can have any voice in this whatsoever.
Jeff, thanks for the call. What do you think, John?
Well, again, this case has been polarizing from the start. And I often tell people that, you know, you can't, you know, trials are not referendums on any type of a movement or an ideology. Criminal trial is just a very narrow proceeding where somebody's charged with a crime and the prosecution has to prove every element of those charges. They have to prove them beyond any reasonable doubt. And so, you know, the people, and I think sometimes various media outlets want to put a particular spin on not just this case, but other criminal trials. And I think that can be a dangerous thing. It really can be, because the trial, all that we learned today from the verdict was that the prosecution didn't prove those five cases beyond a reasonable doubt to that jury.
Thanks for that call. We'll go to Jimmy now in Valley Junction. Jimmy, hi.
Hello. I guess my concern is this kid's going to be a poster boy for anybody that thinks that with a rifle or a handgun that thinks they want to show up to some kind of protest and, you know, make themselves a vigilante. I'm just afraid you're going to have both sides bringing weapons to things like this, and it's going to get out of hand, and pretty soon you're back in Deadwood, South Dakota in the 1880s, and I'll take my comments off the air.
Jimmy, thanks for that call. I've seen other people raise the concern, John, is this a blueprint for someone who wants to show up with a firearm on any side at any issue and hope they can find a justification to use it?
I mean, I think that is a legitimate concern in this case. I mean, I just mentioned saying that we can't, you know, draw a lot of conclusions from an individual criminal case. But I think when we look at the way the law played out in this case and the way the law of self-defense is, when you combine open carry of firearms and you combine people exercising their right to protest and petition, and you also have this environment where people are armed, yes, this is a volatile, dangerous environment. And what we don't want, as the caller said, is to create some type of blueprint for people who want to engage in some type of political violence and use open carry laws and self-defense laws as a kind of pretext to engage in that type of violence.
Thanks for the call. John, as I mentioned earlier, you wrote today that you hope we revisit and maybe rethink how we define self-defense and the standards for its use. Do you think that's likely to happen?
I don't know. I mean, I would have to say that, you know, this is a debate that is complex. It requires people to keep an open mind. It requires people to reach some type of compromise on Second Amendment rights. And there are many folks who are just unwilling to compromise those. And they see any type of limitation on their right to carry firearms or use them in self-defense as a constitutional violation of their rights. And so I would hope that the legislature would have a debate about this, think about what the law is, what it could be, what it should be, and do it in a way that's open and honest. But you know, we are very polarized, so it's a big ask that I'm making of folks.
John, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again.
Oh, my pleasure. Happy to do it.
That's John Gross, Clinical Associate Professor of Law at the University of Wisconsin Law School and Director of the Public Defender Project. He's with us today to talk about the jury's decision in the Kyle Rittenhouse trial, finding him not guilty on all counts. You can follow further coverage from our news team over at WPR.org or watch stories as they post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up after the news, it's this week's edition of Food Friday. We'll get some advice on simplifying our Thanksgiving meals so we can better enjoy the day with friends and family. You can share your Thanksgiving meal advice and tips, and if you'd like to avoid a lot of the hard work, over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.